Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Because even though Klay Thompson was hot and Golden State jumped out to that monster lead, the game was never going to be a beatdown. Watching that game, you had to know that. That was not going to be a beatdown. Never is with these two teams. Never. It didn't matter if Golden State was up 20 or up 50. That game was never going to be a blowout. You had to know that. But it was wild nonetheless. Golden State was up 20. They were rolling. And then the third quarter, Houston made their run. They came back because you knew they would. A team that good and that tough is not going to get blown out. Suddenly, they were getting to every single offensive rebound, every single loose ball. Suddenly, Golden State looked gassed, maybe even on the verge of a complete and total meltdown and implosion. Because Houston just kept coming. And then with Golden State up 66-65 late in the third, this happened.
To Durant. Durant pressured. Drives on jumper. Pull up jumper. KD for two.
He's been the answer. He hurt his right leg. Something happened.
Well, Kevin Durant's hurt. Harden fouled by Iguodala in the front court. Durant.
He's limping.
Trying to walk it off.
He may have turned his ankle coming out of that shot. That's all I can figure.
And he is coming right over to the bench.
I mean, he cannot walk without a he may go right to the training room.
Warriors radio. Let me tell you something. That is something you never want to see. I don't care if you're the biggest Rockets honk ever. I don't care if you hate everything about the Warriors. You never want to see a player, with nobody around, grab their leg and look back. Because everything about that pointed to torn Achilles. I mean, it checked all the boxes. Non-contact, innocuous moment, and worst of all, Durant looking back to see if somebody had kicked him. And for the next 20 minutes or so, that's exactly what that appeared to be. Everything was in the balance. I mean, everything. Forget that game. Forget that series. With Durant, a free agent in a few weeks, the next half decade of the association hung in the balance as he limped off the court and he went down the tunnel. Steph Curry said it best.
Anytime you see something non-contact like that, it's scary. And you could see the look on his face. He didn't really understand what was, you know, was happening in that moment and trying to figure it out.
Then on the other end of the court, the Rockets had to be thinking, man, this is it. This is our chance. The Rockets had to see all that blood in the water. They had come all the way back from that 20-point deficit. And now Golden State's best player in the playoffs was done for the night. They had the champs on the ropes. They had a chance to steal that game, go back home, and then finish. Nobody had to tell the Rockets it was their time. They knew it. It was just a matter of wrapping up on the Warriors' throats and choking them out once and for all. Except it didn't happen. And it didn't happen because the Warriors were still on the floor. The ones that were, they knew it was their moment. Steph Curry jumped in.
During the timeout, we all looked at each other and there were a couple of smiles in terms of like what that meant for us as a team and the guys that were going to need to step up in those moments. Again, next man up mentality. Draymond said that at some point during that timeout. It's hard to remove yourself from thinking about your teammate and your brother as he's back in the locker room getting checked out. But, you know, we were able to lock back in and just find a way to win the game.
That's such a great point. You got to find a way to remove yourself from your brother and your teammate who's in the locker room. Man, just get it done. Do your job. And they did. Curry went from having a quiet night to scoring 12 in the fourth. Jonas Derebko hit a corner three. And then Draymond Green had the most Draymond Green sequence that you are ever going to see.
Paul waits, checks the floor, gets a screen by Tucker. Paul runs in. It's an offensive foul. Draymond Green took a charge with five fouls.
Well, we know he's a big risk taker. Paul is still down, and that was a great, great read by Draymond Green. He knew.
Peak Draymond Green.
Draymond calls for the ball, guarded by Tucker. He's got to be careful here. He's playing with a lot of emotion right now. Klay Thompson with 3:28 to go, catches 10 on the clock, drives it on Harden, throws to Draymond. Draymond fires for three, hits up and good. Draymond Green knocked it down. He screams to the heavens, says, "Let's go."
Dude, he is too much, man. That is the full Draymond Green experience right there. And it's awesome. Like, out tough and then out craft one of the toughest and craftiest guys on the floor by drawing a charge. Give him a little extra. Get a tee. Drain a three. And then, with a little over a minute left, he fouls out, which led to Sean Livingston and Kevin Looney being in the game in the final minute, which led to this all-important sequence.
Thompson dribbles it right up the middle of the floor. Bounce pass to Andre. Andre back to Clay. Clay now turns, looks, and throws the ball away. Gordon's got lost at Looney. Back to Thompson. He goes inside and scores with a left hand. What an ugly play with 4.1 to go. How did that happen?
It was wacky.
In the history of basketball, that might be one of the ugliest plays to end up with a huge basket.
Maybe not that ugly. Pretty ugly. But who was right in the middle of that whole thing? Looney. Looney coming up huge yet again. He grabbed that loose ball. So if game four was the PJ Tucker game, then game five was the Looney game. This guy was a beast. I can't believe he only had 9 rebounds. It felt like 19. How many offensive possessions did that guy keep alive with his work on the glass and his hustle? And how would you describe a Warriors team that's already banged up, already exhausted, already lost a Hall of Famer like Kevin Durant, and still finds a way to win? What would you call a bunch of guys like that? You know, I have a description. I have a thought or two. But you know who's got a better one? Steve Kerr.
Liverpool yesterday came out with just one of the great wins in soccer history. And after the match, their manager, Jurgen Klopp, said, the young kids in Liverpool are probably asleep by now. So I'm just going to go ahead and say it. But our boys are f***ing giants. That's what he said. And I know how he feels, so I apologize to my mom, who is probably watching, but our guys are f***ing giants. Like, that was an unbelievable victory tonight.
Steve bleeping Kerr. What an awesome moment. And he's right. His guys were bleeping giants last night. Draymond, Curry, Clay, Iggy, Sean, Looney, bleeping giants. So what about the other end? The other end of the court. The other end of the spectrum, it's got to leave a mark for Houston. If they don't win that series, last night is going to come back and haunt them all summer and for years to come, because it was right there for them. They fought to get back in that game, but they couldn't finish. Durant gets injured. They couldn't close out that game. They could have ripped that game. They could have gone back home and had a chance to close out the series. Instead, they're going back home with questions. Like, what the hell happened to James Harden in the fourth quarter? Where the hell was the beard? What the hell was he doing when they had a chance to drive a stake through the Warriors once and for all? I mean, the stats have to be wrong, right? There's no way that Harden only took one shot in the final 8.5 minutes of that game. Honestly, and I can't believe I would ever say this about James Harden, but there were stretches where I completely forgot that guy was even on the floor. In the fourth quarter of Game 5, a game where the Warriors lost KD, a game that was right up there for the Rockets to rip, a game where they could have snatched the Warriors' souls and taken control of the series and maybe the entire association. Where was the beard? Again, if they lose that series, that game and that final loose ball is going to haunt them for a long, long time. Except the series is not over. It's still not over. In fact, it's impossible to know exactly where it's going to go now. Because no matter what Kevin Durant's MRI today says, he's not going to play tomorrow night. Hard to imagine he'll play again in the series. Steve Kerr already told The Athletic that he's not playing tomorrow night, which means Golden State's got to go on the road without the guy who's been their best player in the postseason. So what does that mean? Golden State's dead, right? They can't beat Houston without Kevin Durant, right? Wrong. You know, Houston wins Game 6. What's that mean? Can we assume they're going to go back to Oracle and beat them in Game 7? Not necessarily. Golden State still has Steph. Golden State still has Clay. And without Durant, they won't go to the isolations that are a double-edged sword. They can get easy buckets for Golden State. I get that. But they also take Golden State out of their rhythm. So the big question, do the Splash Brothers get back to being the Splash Brothers? Is Kevin Durant really holding them back, as some Warrior fans will tell you? Or if Durant's out for the rest of the series and is out for the rest of the postseason, is this thing now wide ass open, especially given Golden State's lack of depth, which was already a concern before Durant went down? Bottom line, you want the answer? You want me to tell you what's going to happen? I can't. I won't because I can't, and nobody else can either. There is no bottom line. Other than if Houston does not come back, they'll never live down the fact that they didn't finish Golden State last night when they had the chance. The only thing for certain is Game 6 is tomorrow night in Houston, and KD's not going.
Listen, it can be a little frustrating, especially if you're in a hurry or you're running late, to find yourself at a railway crossing waiting for a train. And if the signals are going and the train's not even there yet, you probably can feel a bit tempted to try and sneak across the tracks. Don't do it. Ever. Trains are often going a lot faster than you expect them to be. They cannot stop. Even if the engineer hits the brakes right away, it can take a train over a mile to stop. By that time, what used to be your car is just a crushed hunk of metal. And what used to be you, well, better not to think about that. The point is, you can't know how quickly the train is going to arrive. The train cannot stop even if it sees you. The result is a disaster. If the signals are on, the train is on its way. And you just need to remember one single thing. Stop. Trains can't. Rip Hamilton is my guest. Rip, it's good to have you back. How are you?
Rome, always happy to be back on your show, brother.
My man, good talking to you. Rip, great to hear your voice. So much to talk about, Rip, so let me just jump right into the East, where you have been covering the Boston-Milwaukee series for NBA on TNT VR. How impressed, Rip, have you been with Milwaukee and what they've done in terms of bouncing back after losing game one of that series?
Wow, right? I mean, game one, they kind of got just, like, hit in the mouth. Like, really, like, and as a viewer, we were all looking at it saying, hey, man, okay, we've seen this happen last year, right? But the difference is Giannis Antetokounmpo. I mean, he's a man on a mission right now. And I think that when you look at the Milwaukee Bucks, they've been great all season long on both sides of the ball. And everything starts to end with Giannis. And now all the role players are playing great, too. And I thought that the Milwaukee Bucks did a great job of putting the right pieces around Giannis and putting the right shooters around him and allowing him to be as effective, not just in the half-court setting, but in transition, where I think he's best at. And I think there's not a man on this planet that can stop him when he's in transition. And when you looked at the Boston Celtics, it just seems like they were all over the place all season long. And you hear people, you always hear people saying, "Oh, well, they'll be all right when the playoffs start, and they'll be more connected when playoffs begin." And I was saying to myself, "No, it's not that easy. It's not that hard." Winning the championship when I was in Detroit, we had to make sure that we were playing great basketball going into the season, and I felt like they wasn't. So it sums up their season. They've been on a roller coaster ride. They got all the talent, but I just don't think that the pieces fit.
Great analysis. Rip Hamilton joining us. There's so much in that answer, Rip. Let me ask you about Kyrie. I mean, from the outside, it seems like, from the outside, Rip, that a number of guys in that Boston locker room didn't really like Kyrie as a leader, or at least the way he led. Is that how it looks to you? And if so, how much does that show up on the court?
Well, I think the one thing that we really got to talk about is that these young guys like Rozier and Tatum and Jaylen Brown, these guys had a great season last year. They took the team all the way to in the playoffs into the Eastern Conference Finals, right? So now when we look at the lead, it's a younger lead now. You know, like the vets don't run the lead no more. It's all about the kids that are 23 to 26, right? Like the game has changed. So now when you got young guys that had success in the playoffs, these guys don't want to wait. they want to perform now, right? So how can you tell a guy like Terry Rozier and Jaylen Brown and Tatum to kind of take a back seat when knowing that, hey, you got Kyrie coming back and you got Gordon Hayward? And I don't think it's all about the Kyrie. I think that even when Brad Stevens tried to add Gordon Hayward into the starting lineup when he wasn't ready, when you already got guys, young guys that are thirsty, they ready, they like pit bulls, they want to be out there, they want to show the world that they can play, and he wasn't ready. So that affects the locker room, right? So I think that situations like that and them all getting on the same page and understanding that, hey, we're only going to win a championship as a group, not by individuals. I don't think they ever had that. And I think another question mark is, can Kyrie Irving be the best player on the best team? And I think that's a big question mark that Boston is trying to answer right now, going into now them going into free agency.
Rip Hamilton joining us. You know, Rip, to your point that these guys are young and they're thirsty and they're hungry and they feel like it's their time. And to your point, not only that, but they did prove it last year. Like, they were already doing it. It's not like, hey, give me a shot. They did it last year. They got there. So what about the question you pose when it comes to free agency? You never know what's going to happen, Rip, when it comes to free agency. But how surprised would you be if Kyrie re-signed in Boston?
I wouldn't be surprised either way, right? Okay. Because I think that, like, in order to win a championship, you got to go through bumps in a row like this, right? And even though if they would have got past the Cleveland Cavaliers last year, I mean, no one thought they could beat the Golden State Warriors, right? So I just feel like in order for them to have the success, they still need a guy like Kyrie Irving because they need a closer, and I don't think they have a closer. And Kyrie is one of the best closers in the game, and when you're playing on a big stage and you're trying to win a world championship, you got to have guys that can close games, and he's probably one of the best at it. So I wouldn't be surprised if he comes back to Boston. I wouldn't be surprised if he leaves.
Rip Hamilton joining us. All right, Rip, what about out west? Now, we know Golden State won it all without Kevin Durant, but we know how dangerous they are with KD. We'll wait and see what the MRI says, but if they've got to go without him, how different is this group right now without Kevin Durant?
Oh, man. They're still a great team, right? We know that. But Kevin Durant is the X factor. Kevin Durant is the guy on your team that you can't take out of the game. Like, we've seen Steph Curry struggles in the finals. We've seen Klay Thompson have his struggles. Had a great game last night, but we've seen them guys have struggles. Kevin Durant really doesn't ever struggle for two games in a row. if he's probably one of the most unguardable guys. He is probably the most unguardable guy in the league right now. But with him having him on your team, and when you're not getting anything off of ball movement and guys are not knocking down shots, he's a guy you can throw the ball to and he's going to get you a bucket. So not having – if the MRI comes up negative, positive, and not having him out there on the floor, it's going to be a huge loss and definitely going to impact this team.
Yeah, Rip, what about the Rockets? They had a golden opportunity last night. They came all the way back from 20. Durant goes down, but they just couldn't finish. They could not rip that game that they had to have. How do you think they show up in Game 6?
Well, it all depends on if Kevin Durant plays or not, right? I think that really impacts the game. And them getting an opportunity to go back at home, you know, the playoffs is all about first team that wins on the opposite team's home court, right? So Golden State so far has done their job. Houston looking at it saying, all right, you know what? We got to go home and do our job. We got to come out aggressive. And if he's not playing, we got to take away everything from Steph and Klay. And we got to be more physical than we have been all playoff series long right now. This is a perfect opportunity for us to go out and really put our blueprint from a defensive standpoint and take away their confidence. Make them have doubts in their head saying that, hey, we can't win without Kevin Durant, depending on if he plays or if he doesn't play.
Really quick about James Harden. He had one shot in the last 8.5 minutes of the game. Exactly what was that? I mean, was my man tired? Was that fatigue? Was that something else? How do you explain him not being more aggressive with that game and that series hanging in the balance?
Well, he spends a lot of energy, man. Like, the way that the Houston Rockets play, he doesn't get any easy baskets, right? Like, every possession he has the ball, it's like he's taking on pretty much the whole team, and the whole team knows that he has the ball, so he's falling down on the ground, he's getting to the free throw line, and he's been doing that since day one, since game one of the season. With all the injuries that they had all season long, he's been the guy. And now to be in a playoff situation, it's probably good that they're playing him this early, right? Because, you know, the longer the playoffs drag out, you got to worry about injuries, you got to worry about guys getting tired, fatigue, or whatever. And I think that was a prime example of right there, like, hey, fatigue could be starting to be a factor with James Harden, knowing the load that he has to carry night in and night out.
All right, so Rip, you're working with Intel True VR and the NBA on TNT VR in the postseason. For those who have not experienced it, can you break that down? What is the VR experience like?
Well, it's fun, Jim. I mean, Intel Sports brings fans closer to the game, right? So it's I always say it's like when you put on these goggles, it's kind of like sitting on the floor, but being at home. Mm-hmm. So you're getting the same type of experience if you were at the game, and you have all these different camera angles. So you're actually kind of cool that you can kind of change your seat around. So you can see the game from all from different aspects out of there. And the experience that you have is like being there and getting the commentary of me and Stephanie Reddy, who's been actually great with me. But we're just like hanging out in your living room. We're just talking basketball. It's not all about just analytics. It's about what we're seeing from all the different angles, from all the different camera angles that you might not be able to see when you're calling the game live from a normal telecast. So I think the experience is awesome. It kind of brings kids and fans inside the arena. You see different parts of the game that you wouldn't regularly see on a normal telecast. We got cameras now in the back where the guys actually walk in. We got my favorite cameras being like right behind the basket, that's mounted right behind the basket, because it really gives the viewer the experience of them being there, like in the game, where you can actually touch the players. You can hear the squeaking of the sneakers on the floor. You can see the guys throw elbows every now and then, talk a little trash. And that's the fun things that you might not see from a normal telecast that I definitely enjoy, that I thought that Intel kind of hit a home run on that.
My man, that is one of the best pitches I've ever heard. That's how you do that, Rip. So if people want more information or they want to know how to watch you in VR, how do they go about doing that? Where do they get the info?
Well, yeah, you can go to Oculus. It's where you get the goggles, or Samsung makes a device too. And you go in there and you download the NBA VR app. And then once you download there, you sign on to your local cable subscription. And then you're on. You can watch whatever you want to watch. You can watch games. You can watch YouTube. You can watch movies. You can watch everything on there. So it's cool. So only thing you really have to do is get a set of goggles and download the NBA VR app.
He is an NBA champ, an NCAA champion, a 14-year NBA vet, NBA on TNT, and NBA on TNT VR analyst, Rip Hamilton. My guy, Rip, so good to have you back. I really appreciate that. That was fun. Thank you.
Jim, you've always been one of my favorites. Thanks for having me.
Listen, as any coach or GM will tell you, the foundation of any great team is great talent, of course. It's no surprise, then, that teams dedicate so much time and effort towards finding the right players. And the same rule applies when it comes to hiring. You need top talent, but you don't have endless resources to find it. But what you do have is ZipRecruiter, and they scout the talent for you. With ZipRecruiter, one click, send your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards. But they don't stop there. Their powerful matching technology scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience and then invites them to apply to your job. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 4 out of 5 employees who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within the very first day. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/clones. 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 ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. I owe all of you an apology. You see, when I'm wrong about something, it's important that I step up. I admit it. I own it. That's how this show is. That's how this show has always been. It's about accountability, responsibility. I'm holding guys accountable. I can't do that and not hold myself accountable. Nobody is going to be right about everything. I know this, best of all. So when you're wrong about something, you have to acknowledge it. It's good to acknowledge it. It takes a big man to stand up, be accountable, and admit that they're wrong. And I'm that guy. Because I stand before every last one of you and I admit, I was wrong. I was wrong. And I'm here to own it. And I'm here to apologize for being wrong. I'm going to look you right in the eye. Look you right in the camera. Say it right into the microphone. I was wrong and I'm sorry. And I'm going to make that apology official. Here it goes. I, for one, said I did not think it could get any worse for the Lakers than Magic quitting the front office for Twitter and not telling anybody. Now, let's just think about that for a minute before I finish the apology. Magic Johnson, franchise icon, league icon, quit the Lakers for Twitter. He quit the Lakers for Twitter, and there's nobody who is worse at Twitter than Magic. It's like his drug, Where's James Worthy and Byron Scott and the cap, Kareem, to step in with the intervention and rip this guy's phone right out of his hands? I mean, I always wonder if the stars themselves really thumb out the tweets. No one's asking that about Magic. Yo, Irv, I really hate to break this to you, but you really suck at Twitter. I just hope that nobody else tells him. But back to my apology. I thought the face of the franchise walking out on the team without telling anybody so he could hop on Twitter to congratulate guys who play for other teams was rock bottom. I said it. I meant it. Except this is where I was wrong. I was wrong. I own it. And now I'm going to apologize for it because it has gotten worse. So much worse. Magic dug them a hole and then the rest of the front office jumped into it and kept right on digging. Except me, I'm not going to fall for it a second time. That's why I'm not going to say that the Lakers failing to land Ty Lue is rock bottom. Because when you read how that whole thing went down, I've got confidence that this crew will jack it up even worse. Much, much worse. In fact, this might just be the tip of the iceberg. Ramona Shelbourne tweeted, quote, "Negotiations really deteriorated with Ty Lue when the Lakers refused to offer more than a three-year deal that was designed to line up with LeBron James's contract. Lue felt insulted. The Lakers only saw him as a coach for LeBron," sources close to the process told ESPN. Nice work. Really nice work. You could not have handled that any worse than you did. Well, actually, they could. And they did. Because not only did they insult Ty Lue with their crappy offer, they also reportedly wanted to tell him who he could hire as his assistants. Which is fantastic. Think on that for a minute. If the perception of Ty Lue is that he's only there to coach LeBron, maybe you do something to change that perception. Or you completely underline it by having his deal match LeBron's. Like, you're just telling everybody that you never believed in this guy in the first place. Never mind the fact that Monty Williams got a five-year deal in Phoenix and that Ty Lue has got an NBA championship on his resume as a coach. There's no way this guy should be taking any less. He shouldn't. And then on top of that, you're going to tell him who he has to use as assistants. I mean, are you serious? This guy's not an assistant coach who's never been a head coach. He's got a title. He went to three straight NBA finals as a head coach. Way to insult the guy who was going to be your next head coach. And way to insult the guy who you allegedly were going to bring him in to coach. Oh, and speaking of Monty Williams, Mark Stein has reported that people in the organization who believed in Lue thought the only way to make him the favorite was to wait for Williams to get hired. Another great plan. Really professional. Is there anyone anywhere in that building saying, hey, listen, we're already a laughingstock around the league. Statistically, we're the worst team in the league over the past 6 years. And if we screw this up and it gets out how we screw this up, we are going to look horrible. It's going to make the Knicks look like a well-run organization by comparison. It's going to make Jim Buss look smart in comparison to Genie. Is there not one person in that room to say, the hell are you all thinking? The hell are you all doing? There's no way that a guy who's won a title and been to three NBA finals is taking a job just to take a job. If you think so little of this guy, why are you hiring him in the first place? The hell happened to the Lakers? The hell are any of you doing around there? Jeannie Buss is the smart one. She's the ruthless one. She was the one who canned her brother to change the organization. That was the coolest and coldest thing ever. Now it feels like a mistake. I mean, seriously, bring back Jim Buss. Bring back Jim Buss. When Magic quit for a social media app, that was a chance to become professional, a chance to go out and get some legitimate, experienced front office people. Instead, Kurt and Linda Rambis became more involved. They became more powerful. And then you double down on Rob Pelinka, and that's gone horribly. Like everybody knew it would. I've said it before, let me say it again right now. The Lakers' biggest problem is that they're being the Lakers. It's themselves. They have to stop being the Lakers. This whole month has been the most Lakers month ever. Taking advice from Mr. and Mrs. Rambis. Not exactly Jerry West we're talking about. Like, I don't know what Kurt and Linda bring to the table. I really don't. But I know what they don't bring: a ton of coaching experience. Let me throw some numbers at you. 15 and 17. Those were the number of wins that Kurt had the only time he ever coached a full NBA season. He went 15 and 67, 17 and 65. And this is a guy playing a huge role in all this? So what now? Jason Kidd. He's the backup choice. Juwan Howard, they talked to. What, you going to give Juwan Howard a three-month deal? Ladies and gentlemen, your next head coach, Mario Chalmers. Is Boobie Gibson available? How about my man Delonte West? How play is that?
How play is that, man?
I mean, I can see Jay Kidd. I like Jason Kidd. Juwan Howard would be awesome. It would be awesome because it would be hilarious. Like, yo, Juwan. Juwan, it's me, Rob Pelinka. We played together at Michigan, remember? You don't? You don't know me? Dude, I'm the one who looked like Rob Lowe. Yeah, I knew you remembered. Hey, listen, I run the Lakers now. Well, LeBron runs the Lakers now. Anyway, how would you like to coach an NBA team for free? Dude, we're willing to do that. We're willing to let you come in here and work for free and even sign you to a 10-day contract. Oh, you're not into that. Yo, listen, Jerry Howard. Hey, do you have what's-his-face's name? You know, that other guy that we played with. That dude who called that timeout in the championship game? What's-his-face? Have you got his number? How about Jalen Rose? Dude, do you think Ray Jackson would coach this team? How about Jimmy King? Hey, you talk to Jimmy? Dugan Fyfe, dude. Can Dugan Fyfe do it? What do you think, Jerry? Hey, man, do me a favor. Do me a favor, Jerry. Can you roll up on Michael Talley? If you roll up on him the right way, do you think that maybe he'll take that gig? Or is he previously committed? Dude, no! James Voskal should coach the Lakers. He'd kill it. I don't know, man. I don't know, Rob. You're the freaking Lakers. This is a star-driven town. You need a star on that sideline. Dude, you need Eric freaking Riley. Or if none of the Fab Five or any of the scrubs that they ran with want that gig, maybe Juwan and Bron's former teammate Chris Bosh will. And if Bosh won't take that job because nobody will, maybe my man Mike Miller will. Or you can just go back to my guys in Cleveland. My man, Delonte West. Planes, trains, automobiles. Better have my donuts.
Planes, and automobiles.
And if Delonte won't, how about J.J. Hickson? Planes, trains, robbery with a knife. Dude, I can do this all day. All day long. Lots to cover with Joel Sherman. Joel, good to have you back. How are you?
Good to be back, Jim. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for doing it, Joel. Let me start with the Yankees. They've been obviously decimated, Joel, by injuries, yet they're still just two games out of first in the AL East. Aaron Boone is always going to take a lot of heat when things don't go well. So in your mind, Joel, how much credit does he deserve for the season and how it's gone so far?
I almost feel, Jim, like you deserve credit if in reverse you were going to take the blame, and if they were sitting at like 16 and 21 right now, he'd be getting a lion's share of the blame, even with all the injuries. I think there's something very similar going on. The Nationals are kind of devastated by injuries, and I think their leadership and culture is not that great, and they're kind of underperforming what talent is still there. And, of course, one of the things we're seeing is Davey Martinez, their manager, is on the hot seat. So I always think if you're surviving it well, like the Yankees are, I mean, I think even to some degree the Pirates have, I think the Pirates have used the injured list one more time than even the Yankees this year, and in a tough division, they're surviving it. I think some of the credit's got to go to the manager.
Now, Joel, you mentioned culture. Every single time I have a manager or a coach or a front office person on this program these days, the word culture inevitably comes up. It seems like front offices and coaches are obsessed with it. How would you describe the culture of the Yankees?
Well, I wrote about this a few days ago, Jim, which is just, look, they've had a winning record now for this. If it continues this year, I think it's 27 straight seasons, every year since 1993. And they've either made the playoffs or been in contention at the worst until the final week of the season in all those years. And I assume one of these years they're going to win 76 games. But until I see it, I'm going to assume they'll figure it out. I watched them figure it out in a year where they needed pitchers named Aaron Small and Sean Chacon to pitch great, and Aaron Small and Sean Chacon pitched great. They were in the race until the last week of the season when they had a lineup in, I think it was 2013, with Robinson Cano and what seemed like a bunch of, you know, former guys who used to be able to play but couldn't play anymore, like Ichiro and Vernon Wells and Lyle Overbay and Travis Hafner. And they figured out how to get to the playoffs. I saw them get to the playoffs when early in the season. Yeah, I didn't get to the playoffs that year, but they were in it till the end. I saw them make it when Mariano Rivera blew out his knee on the warning track, and that seemed like a deadly thing. And when Derek Jeter popped his shoulder in the first game of the season. So until I see them not make it, I will assume that they'll kind of figure out a way to get through that. And I just think, in some ways, Jim, they're blessed to play in New York. I know most people think, oh, New York's a tough place to play. But I think because they're under kind of constant scrutiny and by both kind of fan media, but also their history, that they're held to a high standard, it kind of keeps people in this kind of very serious professional next man up bent. And it's existed now from Buck Showalter through Joe Torre, through Joe Girardi, and now Aaron Boone.
You know, now we're getting to something really. Joel Sherman joining us, because I was going to say to you next, Joel, like that culture that we're talking about, is it simply in the walls of the clubhouse and it gets passed down, or is this coming from Brian Cashman?
Well, I think it comes from a lot of places, but I know, you know, look, we're more connected to the fans of teams than ever before because of a variety of social medias, notably Twitter. And I watched a fan base in New York act like a large segment, but some segment with the, you know who screams the loudest, Jim, is people who are upset with things. And they were very upset that the Yankees spent money to bring back CeCe Sabathia and Brett Gardner. And the reality is that Brett Gardner and CeCe Sabathia were good baseball players last year. They, so far when they've played this year, they've been just good. They aren't as good as they were at their peak, but they're good. But they kind of preached the, for better sense of the word, the Yankee way. And I think they're passing it on to a kind of Aaron Judge and Dellin Betanzas and other people I expect will be the leaders of the team after this year when Sabathia is retired. And I think there's a pretty good chance that Gardner won't be back again. And I do think having standards of how you expect to play, handle yourself, really do matter in sports. You know, we see the other places where I know one year the Patriots probably won't win the AFC East, or the Spurs won't make the playoffs, but like the Yankees, until I see it, I'm just going to believe that they're all going to be good.
The Patriot way, the Yankee way, the Spurs certainly have their way. I agree. Joel Sherman joining us. Joel, so what about the Red Sox? They worked their way back to 500. In your opinion, have they finally figured it out and gotten back to being the team that won it all last year, or are there still concerns?
Yeah, I think there's concerns because I think they have legitimate depth issues that can be exposed over the course of the year that in some ways haven't really popped up yet. Like the Yankees have had to find a lot of depth early in this season. The Red Sox have used a lot of farm system over the last few years to go out and do what they did last year. I mean, that's ultimately the goal. It's not to be, you know, the champion of the Baseball America prospect rankings. It's to use whatever you have to get a parade and rings. And they did that successfully last year. But I do think it's left them depth vulnerable this season. That being said, you look at the lineup they send out every day. It's a monster. Guys in their prime who you expect to continue to perform at a very high level. They seem to, on the roll here, find some key bullpen pieces or like guys rise to the occasion. Matt Barnes, Heath Hembree, a few others. And they do, again, without serious injury to their rotation, especially since it looks like Chris Sale has figured it out again. And I know they have David Price on the injured list. As long as they don't have a substantial injury, they have good starting pitching. And quite frankly, the American League, aside from four, maybe five teams, stinks. So you know, there's just going to be a lot of feasting to get records to a certain place. And I think the Red Sox certainly are capable of feasting on the bad teams and getting their record to a place where come July or August, we're thinking, oh, yeah, they had a tough start, but here they are again. They're going to be a factor the rest of the way.
Got a few more minutes with Joel Sherman. So, Joel, what about the Mets? They've lost 5 out of 6. They're 3 games under .500. I understand it's early, but you and I talked about the Yankees and their culture at length. How would you describe the Mets and their culture?
Yeah, so you kind of put some words in my mouth. As somebody who spends a lot of time around both teams, I get to kind of see these laboratories at work. And I do think the Mets have what I might describe as anti-culture, again, until it changes, that what can go wrong and undermine them tends to go wrong and undermine them. I think they're not helped at all by having this chip on their shoulder about the Yankees. So, look, if they had the 10 greatest years in Mets history in a row starting from today, they're never catching up to the Yankee history. The Yankees had a 4 or 5 decade head start, and they've got 27 championships. So, you know, the Mets could win the next 24 in a row, and they'd still be down 27 to 26. And trying to compete with that, I think, is folly. I think that the Mets tend to think when there's positive things in this town written or said about the Yankees and criticism of them, that it's about a conspiracy instead of reality, which is, again, the Yankees have been really good for a quarter of a century plus, and the Mets have never made the playoffs 3 straight years. They pop up, they'll have 2015 and 16, and you think, wow, they're on their way, and then all of a sudden, you know, 2 steps forward, 2 steps back, they're struggling again. And they definitely have a level of talent this season that should suggest serious contention to at least make the playoffs. But I do think they continue to have some depth issues that they'll have to continue to address over the next few years so that when they reach down to the minor leagues, there's real answers there. Or, you know, like what one of the things, you know, you see this in L.A., right, with the Dodgers. Think about some of the Dodger success stories, you know, the Max Muncy types out of no place that even the richest team has. You know, the Yankees out of no place. It's Luke Voit. It's Aaron Hicks. It's D.D. Gregorius. It's Chad Green. It's hard to find, like the Mets don't do that well. They don't create talent out of nothing. And that's the only way you create depth, is if you have good scouting, good analytics, or invest in both worlds, both, and you're able to unearth some stuff that other people didn't see and then develop it to a high end. And the Mets have some depth issues because they haven't done that at a good level.
Joel Sherman, my guest. Joel, how about one more question before I let you go? I'm fascinated by all this, but I've got to ask you about the Marlins because they're already 16 games below .500. Again, it is early, but it seems like they're pretty much eliminated from contention by the end of April, if not before the season. How much of this, then, is on Derek Jeter, and how much of it is on his predecessors?
Yeah, I think the weight is on both of them. Right now, I hope I remember all 4 names as I do this, right, is you can make a case, Domingo Germán, Chris Paddock, Trevor Williams, and Luis Castillo are 4 of the best pitchers in baseball right now. They were all traded by the old administration of the Marlins for almost nothing. And if they were sitting with those 4 pitchers, pretty good chance you might not have even had to trade all the position players. But even if you did, you would have a young core of starting pitching where you'd be saying right now, wow, the Marlins have something to build around. And then this new administration came in and traded away all the best of what was left, which was position players. And clearly to date, and sometimes this takes a long time to gestate, Jim, but to date, they have hardly gotten enough back for what they gave up, especially for Christian Yelich. And, you know, you put those two things together, bad yesterday, bad today, well, you got a really, really bad present and not a great looking near future. And, you know, I think there's a lot of pathology there. It's not too much to go into in a short radio interview, but I think it's going to be hard for them to get over it anytime soon. And I do think a big key to the NL East, and this isn't splitting the atom. It's been talked about a lot. Is you better figure out how to throw up a 15-4 against the Marlins if you're the Phillies or the Mets or the Nationals or the Braves, because they're the easy pickings in the division, and it's a way to kind of get 10 over real easy against one opponent. And if you don't do it and your rivals in the division do it, you're going to be playing from behind.
Contractors can rely on Ferguson to provide a winning game plan for any job, any day. Thanks to their pro pickup service, you can choose from thousands of products to order online and pick up in store, which makes doing business with Ferguson the easiest part of your day. All right, so if you live in America right now, you fall into one of three groups. Either you crush Game of Thrones on a weekly basis, or you're crushing Game of Thrones trying to get caught up for the series finale in 10 days, or you have never seen a single episode and you cannot wait for this cultural supernova to burn out so you do not have to hear about it anymore. Now, if I gave you one guess as to which of these three groups that Alabama head football coach and noted red ass Nick Saban were to fall into, which group would you say? Remember, this is a dude so allegedly locked into football that he didn't even know that there was a presidential election back in 2016.
Well, to be honest with you, I didn't even know yesterday was election day. It was so important to me that I didn't even know it was happening.
Yeah, sure you didn't, Nick Tater. Yeah, but fine. Let's go ahead and suspend disbelief and pretend for a second that the highest paid public employee in Alabama somehow missed a presidential election. And then let's factor in that he once said the only TV that he ever watches is the Weather Channel. Knowing that, or at least believing that, would you make this guy a prime candidate to probably be the one person in the entire world who has no idea what Game of Thrones is? But if you thought Game of Thrones had plot twists, wait until you hear this. Because not only does Saban know what Game of Thrones is, he freaking loves it. Not my words, his. And he said as much yesterday on WJOX 94.5.
Well, I love it. I mean, you know, it had to come to this. Somebody's going to win, somebody's going to lose. That's the way it always goes. Everybody's probably got, you know, somebody that they're rooting for, which is how it goes too. So it'd be interesting to see how it winds up.
Do you have a theory on who will be on the Iron Throne when it's all said and done?
I don't know. I think some kind of way Jon Snow's going to wiggle his way in there, even though he won't try. It'll just end up that way.
Wait, what? Have you ever heard a guy so enthusiastic or that guy so enthusiastic to talk about anything at all? Check out the Nick Tater breaking down season 8. He's even got a prediction on who's going to sit on the Iron Throne and rule the Seven Kingdoms. I mean, did I just hear what I think I heard? Now, if you watch that show, you can tell by that clip that the Nick Tater is not chasing to get caught up. He's all caught up. He's already there. His theory on Jon Snow is based on last Sunday's episode when the Starks learned for the first time that old Johnny Boy has a blood claim to the Iron Throne. So Saban is a fan. That's where he lives. And there's reason to believe that he's been watching since 2011. And not just watching, my man is scouting. Check out the dude telling the world whose living room that he'd post up in with a letter of intent in one hand and a pen in the other.
The White Walkers were the bad dudes, man. I mean, if we were recruiting, we would go north and try to recruit some of those guys.
Holy crap, Nick. Game of Thrones takes 4 days. Remember, this is a guy who melted down after being asked about his quarterback situation last year. But he's got no problem telling us that he tried to recruit the White Walkers to Tuscaloosa. I see you working, Nick. Now let me help you round out the rest of your squad. No question. You got to go and get the Night King to play quarterback after that dime javelin that he threw right into the heart of a dragon last season. That's the kind of accuracy and confidence you need to play SEC football. Then you gotta put the Mountain and his brother the Hound on the line to protect him, because nobody's getting through those guys. Your boy Jon Snow, he is the perfect Adam Thielen-like wide receiver. All talent, no diva.
and you may as well put Brienne of Tarth at tight end to set those picks and blocks for Jon Snow, because she's a known protector of the Starks. And in the backfield, no question, you're going to hand the rock to Arya. No one is more elusive, and she's already proven that she can carry the ball with both hands. Just ask the Night King 2 episodes ago. Your OC, Tyrion Lannister, no doubt. And your pregame entertainment is Daenerys circling Bryant Denny on a fire-breathing dragon. And if Auburn thinks the War Eagle is badass, wait till they come to your house and look up at a freaking dragon patrolling the Alabama skies. Look, you're going to need all the help you can get, Nick, because Dabo Swinney went full Cersei on your ass last season. And unless you want to bend the knee again at King's Landing, you better bolster up that squad with these killers. Now, I don't know if Saban can get everyone to Bama in time for next season, but I do know what he's going to be doing the next 2 Sunday nights. Inhaling Little Debbie oatmeal cream pies and crushing Game of Thrones. Even if it's just to scout imaginary talent. Hey, Nick. Wasn't that fun? Nick, have you ever looked cooler than you did right there? And then in my description of what you did right there? Hey, Nick, see what happens when you show a little personality? You become more likable. You become more relatable. And you know what the most amazing part of this is? People like you. People relate to you. And no one anywhere is questioning your commitment to football because you're having a little bit of fun. You see, you can have your little Debbie and eat it too. You don't always have to be a no-fun red ass. In fact, it's a lot better when you're not. And nobody is questioning your commitment. Keep it up. He also said that he does get inspiration. It's not just entertainment. He gets inspiration from that show and is using that inspiration in some speeches that he's about to make.
Barrett Jones tells us your Friday night speeches were his favorite part of being a player at Alabama. Can you use any Game of Thrones in that?
Oh, I think there's a lot of lessons to be learned in that. I know it's a fictional type, you know, show, but, you know, you sort of get attached to the characters and, you know, some of the perseverance that they go through and some of the things that they do, because they are actually competing, you know, with all the sort of...
Hey, Nick, let me jump in on you for a minute.
That go on.
It's not fictional type. It's not a fictional type of show. Bro, there are dragons in the show, all right? It's fictional. It's not sort of fictional or fictional type or slanted towards fictional. It's fictional.
Fictional type.
He happens to be Howard Beck. What's up, Howard? How are you?
Romy, how are you, sir?
Good, good. Howard, how about you?
I'm doing great.
Listen, Kyrie and the Celtics imploded. The Bucks advanced. The Lakers and Ty Lue. The Warriors and the Rockets. Kevin Durant getting hurt. I guess what I'm saying is, how was your Wednesday night?
Yeah, head still spinning a little bit. It feels like this whole postseason has been like this, hasn't it? I mean, ever since the night that, you know, Magic just decided to resign out of the blue, and we all just, like, you know, we're stuck on Twitter the whole night just watching it unfold, and it feels like this is just an extension of that. This whole, the last month or so has just been a wild ride, and I don't even know where to begin with last night. But I think, you know, Durant's injury looms above all of it, right? Because the far-reaching potential effects of that go so far beyond just this series and these playoffs. But yeah, I mean, that Kyrie flaming out and what that means for the Celtics and where he may go, it just feels like the entire NBA is in a state of flux, and we're still weeks away from even seeing who wins the championship.
Right. Howard Beck joining us. Depending on the severity of Kevin Durant's injury, I mean, if worst case scenario, that could impact the league over the next 5 years. Best case scenario, just over the next few weeks. But what about this? Steph Curry had 12 points. Howard in the fourth quarter after KD went down. Is that just a function of somebody needing to step up in that moment, or is that a function of some of the KD isolations going away and Golden State's offensive rhythm coming back?
I mean, listen, it's everything, really, right? Because we know what this team was before Durant arrived. We know this was a team that won a championship, that won 73 games, that was built on the strength of Steph Curry's shooting and playmaking and Klay Thompson's shooting, Draymond Green's playmaking, all of that. And so, it, you know, none of that went away. Steph Curry didn't all of a sudden stop being the guy who won back-to-back MVPs, including one unanimously. He accommodated Kevin Durant willingly. That was the whole plan when they got him. And, you know, I know that at times it has seemed like, you know, people have wondered if Steph Curry was kind of, you know, shrinking within that offense. But you know that that capability is still there. And so, I mean, look, that was desperation last night. That was necessity. That was Steph Curry showing that, you know, when push comes to shove, even with a dislocated finger, even with whatever else may be ailing him, he's still capable of being that guy, and he has to be, and he's going to have to be, you know, at least one more time just to get out of this series. And who knows if we're going to see Kevin Durant again in this postseason.
Howard Beck joining us. You know, you're on this topic, but let me ask you this. Like, when it comes to Durant and the Warriors, there's a school of thought that will start with a sentence that's something like, well, I'm not going to say the Warriors are worse with Durant, but you've heard that. So, like, what do you make of that? Is that just people doing what people do, or is there actually something to that? Is there a discussion?
No, I think it's a completely invalid one, and I understand it. And, it's, you know, look, we're going to – as much time as we spend analyzing these teams – and overanalyzing at times, I think that every single theory is going to come out at some point. So if there are people who have lobbed that out there, I get it. But no, listen, they have been stronger for having Durant. They needed somebody who could play in isolation when necessary, right? That's not the Warriors' personality. They're not a team that wants to rely on isolation ball, on individual heroics. They're not a hero ball team. They're a ball and player movement team. And at their best, it's beautiful to watch. But sometimes that gets taken away from you. Sometimes it bogs down. And the Rockets, for the last two springs in a row, have done a good job of taking the Warriors out of that. And that's when you need a release valve like Kevin Durant. Without him, you know, it does put them in a vulnerable position, because as gifted as Curry is, he can create some on his own. But you know, that's not his strength is not going to be to go break down a defense, and he certainly can't shoot over guys the way that Kevin Durant can. And Durant is a rare, you know, individual in so many respects, but not least of which is that because of his skill set and size, he can get a shot off anywhere. They're going to miss that, period. But if they return to essentially their old personality of just a constant ball and player movement, those backdoor cuts, everything else, they can manufacture offense, and they still do have the best shooting backcourt in NBA history.
We're talking to Howard Beck. All right, then, Howard, go back to the Rockets. It was not an elimination game last night, but given how shaky the Warriors were in the second half and the fact that Durant was out, how much of a missed opportunity was that for Houston?
Oh, I mean, huge, huge missed opportunity. Because, you know, first of all, there's just the basic statistics. We know, you know, tie series at 2-2, the game five winner wins the series, what, 82% of the time, whatever. So there's that. The chance to steal a game there. The chance just to deflate the Warriors at that point, too. I mean, if you think about the 1-2 punch of losing Durant potentially for the rest of the postseason and losing the game, I mean, that just would have been just, you know, devastating. And so it's a huge missed opportunity for the Rockets. But look, they've got a home game coming, knowing that Durant is not playing, and, you know, they're going to feel pretty confident. I have no doubt about that. And, you know, I think it's more likely than not that we're seeing a game seven.
We were talking to Howard Beck. I was going to say, Howard, given the fact that each game in this series has been a two-possession game and KD is out, and you answer this in part, is there any way to predict how this thing's going to play out?
No, and that's fine. Like,
right.
The thing is, I don't want to say it's great that Durant is out. It's not. It's terrible for basketball. It's terrible for the NBA. It's terrible for fans. It's terrible for everybody except for, I guess, the Rockets and their fans. But even before he went down, I would say that the beauty of this second round has been that we've had a lot of suspense and mystery just kind of woven into it. You know,
it's not surprising the Celtics went down last night, but it is surprising if you bet from if you go back to the start of the second round, it would have been shocking to think that they were going to go out in five. Like, I thought all four series before the second round began had a chance to go the distance. And we still may see, you know, a couple of these go the distance. And, you know, I'm not about to try to predict where this one is going. The Warriors winning a game six is a huge task on the road, but they can pull it off. They're the kind of team that has, you know, obviously done great things in the postseason and on the road. It wouldn't surprise me if they pulled it off. It won't surprise me if it goes to a game seven. It won't surprise me which way that game seven goes. I mean, I feel like we're helpless when it comes to predictions right now, and that's fine. I'd rather I enjoy the suspense.
I said the same thing, Howard. There's nothing to me. There's no certainty other than game six is tomorrow night, and that KD will not go. We'll find out when the ball goes up. All right. So you mentioned the Celtics. Nearly 2 years back, you yourself raised the question: is Kyrie a franchise star? What did you see then that inspired that question, and how much has that answer changed since then?
You know, his years in Cleveland were kind of an interesting mix, Jim, because before LeBron got there, as we know, as great as Kyrie was, and he was young, but they just couldn't win. They couldn't even get anywhere near the playoffs before LeBron arrived. And then during the LeBron years, every time LeBron was out, anytime he missed any stretch of games, Kyrie wasn't enough. Even with Kevin Love there, even with a strong veteran supporting cast, Kyrie had a losing record without LeBron. And there were just certain things about him that, you know, you could see and you could hear just whispers from within the Cavs and around the league about Kyrie's makeup during those Cavs years, that he was moody, that he could be kind of detached, that, you know, if you watched him, you could see he tended to still be kind of ball dominant. He wasn't, you know, a great distributor. He wasn't a great defender, although occasionally he decided to play defense at a high level and you'd say, oh, wow, well, he can do it. Let's, you know, why doesn't he do that more often? So there were just all these kind of caveats that came with him, especially if you wanted to put him in the role of franchise star with all the responsibility and burdens and expectations that come with that. And when the Celtics made that trade, the reason I wrote that column at the time was partially my own impressions, but as you people can see in the column, it was a lot of me talking to people with the Cavs, scouts around the league, other executives who all had some of those same concerns that, yeah, he's incredibly talented, great potential, and maybe he evolves and becomes a better leader, a better defender, a better distributor. But what if he doesn't? And what are the Celtics banking on with this trade? Now, I'm not questioning the trade itself, especially at this point. Obviously, Isaiah Thomas was damaged goods, and you know, Jay Crowder was a nominal piece, and the pick, instead of being a top three or top five pick, became the eighth pick, and it's Colin Sexton. This is not to say that the trade was suddenly a mistake. On the Celtics side of it, I'm not sure who won that trade ultimately, but what it is to say is that there were doubts and some concerns about Kyrie Irving as a franchise star at the time the Celtics acquired him, and I think those same concerns are certainly prominent right now, and it's all, you know, those are all the things everybody was talking about when they went down last night, and including Grant Hill on NBA TV questioning, you know, whether Kyrie was the right fit and was ready to take on all those responsibilities.
Howard Beck, my guest, senior NBA writer for Bleacher Report. Oh, Howard, I got a question. What the hell is happening with the LA Lakers?
Man, if only I knew, Jim.
The hell with the Lakers?
They are not the Lakers that I covered for 7 years through the Shaq Kobe era. And that was a chaotic, crazy era. But, like, you know, they were winning. And, they, you know, there was some dysfunction on the court at times. But, you know, the place operated, you know, fairly professionally and smoothly. I don't know what to make of things right now. I'm sitting here at a distance, just looking and I'm baffled, frankly. It doesn't feel like they've made a single right decision in the last month.
So if you're LeBron James, what are you thinking about this organization, the one that you signed with less than a year ago?
He's got to have doubts, right? I mean, we're not going to hear them anytime soon, if ever, maybe down the road if we ever do hear. But he's, you know, he wanted to be in L.A., and everybody around the league kind of felt this at the time that he chose the Lakers last summer anyway, that this was so much about, you know, lifestyle and the stage of his life that he's at and where his family wanted to be, where he wanted to be. It was about location, and it was about wanting to be part of this storied franchise, sure. But it's not as if he chose the Lakers because they had the best chance to contend immediately, right? Like, that's evident. He could have gone to Philly. He could have gone to Houston. He could have gone to teams that were in contention immediately. And he could have gone to a number of teams that were more stable. I mean, the Lakers have been in a state of flux for a while here. But, you know, I think he just kind of assumed things would, you know, smooth their way out and that, you know, they'd get on the right track and that he'd be part of that. And right now, you know, I don't pretend to know what's in LeBron's head, but I can't imagine he's happy seeing the way that things are unfolding.
So, Howard, finally, I got about 90 seconds. Like, Jeannie Buss is really smart. People love her. What do you think she's thinking right now? Why is she surrounding herself with who she has surrounded herself with? And what's her game plan?
Yeah, and I wish I knew the answers to those questions. I've known Jeannie since, you know, early in my NBA writing career. I mean, going back to when I started covering that team. And she's everything you just said. She's really bright, great person, and somebody I've, you know, had plenty of conversations with on and off the record over the years. I have not spoken to her during this span, and I don't suppose she's very available right now to any of us in the media. I am puzzled by the way she and Rob Pelinka have gone about this whole process. And from the moment they lost Magic Johnson, everybody around the league thought the same thing. This is a chance to reset. This is a chance to get a more seasoned, polished front office in charge and go from there. And instead, Rob Pelinka, who's, you know, not had a great track record so far and doesn't have great relations around the league, is the one, you know, moving this thing forward. And they don't have a complete front office. It's, you know, and it's showing in this coaching search.
That's absolutely fair. He is a senior NBA writer at Bleacher Report. He is a contributor to NBA TV and NBA Radio. Also a good friend of the program, Howard Beck. That's how you close the show. Howard, thank you very much. Always good to talk to you. Great job.
You too, Jim. Thanks, man.
Good night now!